TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Behind the scenes of the Millennium Meeting. Unchecked power of global corporations. The United States claims to be the world's largest democracy, but is that really true? And what are the criteria that determine whether a given country is a democracy, whether people rule or money? Richard Grossman says that the test case for a democracy is who is in charge, who exercises real power. In the U.S. today, he says, private corporate power is larger than public power. The people's fundamental right to govern ourselves does not exist, he says, and the government that should remedy this inequity is on the other side. Richard Grossman was speaking in New York in September of 2000 at a teach-in called by the International Forum on Globalization. The meeting dealt with the growing global corporate influence over the United Nations. Richard Grossman.
The United States is not a democracy. I don't think it's ever been a democracy. And it's very painful to say that. I think it's painful to hear it. I think we need to talk about it in terms of what the implications are. Because as we frame a problem, as we frame a question, so is shaped our response to it. So is shaped our goals. So is shaped our strategy and our tactics. So is determined the political arenas in which we want to struggle. A few years ago, the people of Massachusetts passed a law. It wasn't the most radical law in history. It basically put some limits on the ability of state officials to use taxpayer money in Massachusetts to do business with companies doing business with the dictators in Burma. It wasn't a ban, it was a limitation. What happened? Private power in the form of the institutional form of the corporation nullified that law. This law allegedly was about democracy in Burma. What the process demonstrated was that there wasn't democracy in Massachusetts or in the United States. Here's what happened. A shill nonprofit corporation, a propaganda corporation called the National Foreign Trade Council, which is made up of global corporations all around the world, went right to federal court after the law was passed and said, this law is beyond the authority of the people of Massachusetts to pass. We want you to declare it unconstitutional. A federal court immediately put an injunction on the law. The state appealed. It went to the Supreme Court. In June, by a vote of 9-0, meaning it was a triviality, the Supreme Court declared the law unconstitutional. If that's not an example of private wealth nullifying, overturning, kicking around the people of Massachusetts, I don't know what is. What's as important is the logic here of the courts. And basically what they're saying is that a public constitutionalized commonwealth, Massachusetts, may not establish criteria for how to spend its money. But a so-called private corporation may. Right? A private corporation, business corporation, it can have criteria because it's private and it's governed by private law. But a public entity, a state government, constitutionalized, with elections, legislature, judiciary, executive, you know, all these things, a Bill of Rights, which we have in Massachusetts, that's contrary. It's beyond the authority of the people. Well, we can all make lists. When lumps of capital, agglomerations of capital, nullify public policy, they're asserting a special privilege under protection of the rule of law, under protection of the law. The Supreme Court, of course, cited the United States Constitution as its authority in declaring this unconstitutional. What we have when Corporations have permits to pollute, when they legally put out poisons, when corporations act as persons, mobilizing behind the Bill of Rights, behind the First Amendment, free speech, free association, trying the 14th Amendment, when corporations are said to be owed due process, they're owed equal protection of the law. Because why? Because the court found them to be legal persons a century ago. Because they are centers of wealth and power, they are in fact trampling upon our fundamental rights. And in totality, it is our fundamental right to govern ourselves. That's what's going on here. That it's we can't say that when corporations pollute or when corporations do this or all the long lists of things that we'll be hearing today, that these are assaults on democracy or corrosions of democracy or subversions of democracy. These are evidence of no democracy. Otherwise, they wouldn't be happening. Otherwise, there would be remedies for this that doesn't involve 10 years of organizing on single issue after single issue after single issue. This toxic here and that dump there and that new technology there and genetically modified foods there. So, in one sense, it's kind of terrifying because we do not control our government. We never have. The Constitution was written for a minority of people, a property people, to control this country. And they made it incredibly difficult for when the 80% of human beings, of bipeds, who were defined as non-persons in the Constitution, eventually became legal persons, they made it extraordinarily difficult for the majority ever to really govern in this country. And it's extraordinary to go back and look at even the debates around the ratification of the Constitution. Sometimes I've been accused of saying, you're putting values on dead, you know, you're using the values of today to judge dead people of 200 years ago. Baloney. There were plenty of live people 200 years ago who judged the other live people based on their criteria and their values. And you go back and look at the debate over the ratification of the Constitution, which was, by the way, the first fast track, because they couldn't change it. All you could do was vote it up or down. And you had a lot of people saying, hey, this is not what we had in mind. This is a plan for a global commercial empire. Some very prescient people back there. The Supreme Court is going to be the property safety net unto eternity. You know, what kind of democratic process is when you give the final say to judges? In none of the 13 states during the period of the Articles of Confederation was there a court that could overrule a legislature. That was a total new contrivance. So what we have is a structural problem where the rights of the majority to govern ourselves have been diminished. And the ability of a minority working through their major political and economic vehicles, the corporation, is enormous. And their rights have been increased by the courts and legislatures over the last 200 years. So we have a problem. We turn to our government for a remedy, as we're taught to do. But our government is complicit in the harms. Our government is complicit in the fundamental denial of our rights as people, as citizens, as the sovereign people, as the source of all political authority in this country, is we the people. You know, when the revolutionaries seized sovereignty from England, they didn't take the sovereignty of the king and put it in the state governments. They didn't put it in the federal governments. They said the sovereignty goes to the people. Well, 80% of the people weren't people, but that's been taken care of. All right? It's our job. It's our work. So on the one hand, that should come as a terrifying idea. It also should come as something of a relief. Because if, in fact, we're not running this country, if, in fact, we don't have the authority to run this country, if we're not capable of acting like the sovereign people, of being we the people, isn't it extraordinarily logical that through the course of the last century, we're resisting one assault after another, endlessly, relentlessly, one technology, another technology, you know, one war, another war, one buying of a candidate, one buying of campaigns. Aren't you tired of having to master all these technologies and all this data and all this information? We're always on the defensive. We turn to our government for redress, and they're on the other side. So we have to figure out a different way. And one of the exciting things to me of the last couple of years, especially since Seattle, this new ferment that's growing up, is that I think in this country, where the consciousness is not high, because we're the center of empire, we're the last to hear everything, right? The people in other countries know a lot more than we do about what our government is doing, about what our country is doing. And I think it's been extremely helpful for people in this country for that to have grown up such a movement around these global trade treaties and global trade issues. It's helped a lot of people in the U.S. turn their gaze back to our own histories, to learn what we haven't learned about our own history, to learn about the founding fathers, and to learn about the Constitutional Convention, to learn about the great popular movements of the 19th century, which were so different in character from the popular movements of the 20th century. Because I think in the 19th century, what characterized the great popular movements, from the abolitionists to the populists, was that they understood from the beginning to the end, even when the populists were crushed, they understood that the issue was about rights. It wasn't about the most efficient technology. It wasn't about transparency. It wasn't about voluntary codes of conduct. It wasn't about CEOs saying they're going to do the right thing. It was about who is in charge. When you go back and look at the literature, you look at the platforms of the People's Party in 1892, it's either the companies will own us, either we'll own the companies and control the companies, or they will own us. That theme is just dominant throughout the century. They understood that they were fighting for the authority to be the sovereign people. They understood that you can't have half a democracy, a little bit of democracy. Either you have democracy where the people govern, or you don't have democracy. You have plutocracy, or you have something else. And the big change in the 20th century in terms of organizing, from my perspective, is that too many people have forgotten or don't know that history. By World War I, the corporations really had achieved an incredible degree of control under law. Anybody that thinks that the First Amendment, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, has been a powerhouse of protection for individuals uttering un-American things should go back and look at the history. I mean, it's terrifying to hear about all the counterattacks and the use of the FBI. But where did the FBI start? The FBI started in the Palmer raids after World War I. All kinds of people socialists and anarchists and labor organizers were arrested, thrown in jail. Their offices were broken into. Everything. How many corporate CEOs have been deported for saying un-American things in the history of this country? I mean, what has been the role of the state in deciding what issues are public and what issues are private? What has been the role of the state in deciding the authority of the people to actually govern in this country? It hasn't been a good record. It hasn't been a good record. So we need to make some very powerful adjustments in our analysis and in our tactics and our strategies in this country. Because we are not only resisting the global corporations, but we're also resisting the minority of property people in this country that control these corporations and through the corporations control the government and control our minds and propaganda. I make no distinction between giant corporations. There's no such thing as a good corporation or a better corporation. And it's nothing personal. Right? Corporations exist to concentrate power and wealth. They exist to rule. That's their function. That's their purpose. And nowadays, they rule with the cover of law, with the protection of the law. And I guess they always have in this country. When our learned judges need to find something in the Constitution that, even though the word corporation doesn't appear in the Constitution, they need to find that corporations have intangible property rights. They need to find the corporation is a person. They need to find that a corporate charter is a contract protected by the Constitution. They need to find that the Commerce Clause protects the corporation from state intervention. They'll find it. So, in closing, I would say that we need to nurture in this country a democracy movement. You know, sometimes, very often, people from other countries come here and say, we're building a democracy movement in our country. Will you help us? You know, and we do. And our heart goes out to them. And we're not offended that they don't have democracy in their country. Well, how do we build a democracy movement in our country? Maybe we can learn from folks in other countries. But we have to nurture this. We have to go from this single issue struggle, single issue after single issue, technology after technology, one corporation after another corporation, the buying of this politician, the buying of that politician, to saying, how do we take control of our government? Not take back because we've never had it, so we have to do something that's new. But you know, how do we start our own city councils and our own state and county legislatures? How do we create crisis of jurisdiction? How do we challenge the notion that the corporation is a person and challenge the Commerce Clause and challenge the Contract Clause and challenge all the rationalizations that they put forward to say we have no authority? A couple of years ago, I had the good fortune to meet with Thomas Berry. Some of you may know his book about the origin of the planet. He's a cosmologist. And he said, what are you boys up to? He's about 85. He can call us that. And I said, well, this was from my perspective 4 or 5 years ago. We want to eliminate the 1,000 largest corporations from the face of the earth. So he looked at us for a very long time. You know, he was thinking. Geologic time, he was thinking. And he said to us, why do you have such low aspirations?
That was Richard Grossman. He founded the Project on Corporations, Law and Democracy and co-authored a very influential pamphlet called Taking Care of Business, Citizenship and the Charter of Incorporation. He travels around the country conducting workshops for activists to rethink corporations and democracy. Next up is Danny Kennedy, the outgoing director of the Berkeley, California-based nonprofit Project Underground. Project Underground works internationally in support of communities that are affected by mining and oil drilling. Danny Kennedy.
It's a great honor to be here again. Tony started by mentioning the last IFG teach-in, which was in November 1995, on the very sad occasion of Ken Saro-Wiwa and the Ogoni Nine's execution. And I wanted to start, and my speech will be a series of stories, if you can bear with me, with a story that was subsequent to that dreadful episode in a sorry saga of the Ogoni people and their struggle against Shell in the Niger Delta. And it concerns the fate of other Ogoni activists who had been equally active as Ken and the leaders that were murdered on that day, November 10th, 95, but who were not actually executed quite so clearly. Although, during the period 1994 to 1996, just to be very real, 2,000 Ogoni were murdered on the ground in their villages by Nigerian soldiers. That's a well-documented fact, and it was done at the behest of Shell. I mean, we not only have affidavits in our office that show that the key witnesses for the prosecution at Ken's execution trial were bribed by Shell executives. We have proof that Shell requisitioned the ammunitions that the soldiers used to make the raids on the villages when these 2,000 people were killed. One of the lead officers in charge of those raids, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Okuntimo, was actually on field allowances paid for by Royal Dutch Shell Corporation. This is the involvement, the complicity between the dictatorship that was the Nigerian military government then and still is now, sadly, and the corporation. And so those nine were killed, and supposedly, you know, that was kind of the end of the story. Well, not exactly. There was continuing repression and reprisals on the ground against the effective organizing of the Ogoni that had kicked Shell out of their kingdoms in 1993. And many of the lead activists had to flee into exile into Benin, neighboring Nigeria. And I went to the camp that the UN had established in Benin under the control of the Beninois government in 1998, to visit with some of the people, and it was one of the saddest experiences of my life to visit with 800, 1,000 or so incredible activists, people like yourselves and more, like that had faced this difficult struggle and organized on their campuses and in their schools and at their universities and so on in order to boot Shell out and keep Shell out because of the pollution and the damage and destruction that they had wrought in the 35 years Shell had operated in Ogoni. And they were forced to flee their homeland and live in this squalid camp. And I mean, I'm talking about victims of unspeakable torture, kids younger than, you know, 20 who had been abused in ways I can't repeat here. And they were sitting in this squalid camp, no support from the United Nations system. And so we ran at Project Underground a quick and dirty campaign, to be honest. It wasn't something we had a lot of resources to do. We sent a human rights researcher back to the camp after I returned to the United States. She sat in the camp for a couple of months and took testimony, took their stories. You know, What's your relation to Shell? What did they do to you? How did you get forced out of the country? What was it that made you flee and leave your home and your family and everything you had? And we wrote this down and we published it in a report that we called the Shell Shock Refugees Report. And it had a little postcard tear-off thing in the back. And one of them was to Shell just saying, God damn you for doing this to these people. And the other one was to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees to say, take responsibility for these 800 people. Do the right thing by these people. Process them. Treat their psychological wounds. Heal them. Help them. Because they are political asylees in the truest sense of that word. And, you know, we did a couple of follow-up visits here in New York to the UN, and we had a delegation of Nigerians go to the Geneva office of the UNHCR. And within a year, we had 600 of those people resettled. They were sent to the United States as political asylees. I don't know, maybe someone here is one of them. They're active now here fighting the oil industry. Many of them relocated to Louisiana, would you believe, so they're dealing with Cancer Alley now. But, you know, it was a great victory. The reason I tell you that story is not to brag about a successful, quick and dirty campaign, but to say, can you imagine if this global compact thing had been a done deal then, just last year? If Shell was one of the companies funding the United Nations, having funded directly the UN Secretary General's office itself, of course Shell would have pulled strings. Shell pulled strings with the Nigerian dictatorship. Shell pulled strings with the British government, with the Dutch government. Any institution it needs to do its business, it gets to do its business. And that's what it's doing with the United Nations. So Shell, the evil institution which had persecuted these people for those 35 years and more, is now partnered with the United Nations, who was responsible and fortunately in this case did actually do the right thing by them and give them the support they needed to resettle and start new lives. That's the sort of problem we face with the idea that the United Nations is becoming a corporate vehicle. I was thinking I should quote Jefferson because he was one of the founding fathers of this country, and he admitted at one stage his darkest fear was about a corporate aristocracy, I think was the term, or an aristocracy of corporations was the expression he used at that time. The point is good that for the longest time in this country, we have been fighting the corporations, and we've been losing that fight. And now the United States, the empire, and its arrogance has externalized that onto so many other countries through its various proxies, whether it be by war or by connivance through the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and whatever other institution it controls. And now it's doing it to the United Nations, which had this once upon a time great internationalist vision, which, as Phyllis rightly said, we should be uphold and try to regain. We need a separation of powers, not just in the United States, not just with Dick Cheney and George Bush, for God's sake, the oil boys, along with the other oil boy, Al Gore, pretending to be president, but at the United Nations level, we need to separate those powers. The little dilly bag I bought here was for another story, which is it's my souvenir from Rio de Janeiro, the Earth Summit in 1992 where I was. I was one of the 50 young people that was arrested and thrown out of the Earth Summit because we said this is a hogswash, this is bollocks, this is complete nonsense, we've sold out. This Earth Summit thing, the so-called Parliament of Parliaments, the Parliament of the Planet, the answer to the long quest for sustainable development, was a complete sellout. And I'll explain in different ways how that was. Back in March in 1992, 3 months prior to the actual signing and sealing of the various instruments of the Earth Summit process, the real decision-making was getting done here at the United Nations in New York by the diplomats who'd been negotiating the various conventions and other ideas like Agenda 21. And it was there that we first started cottoning on to just how much of a corporate fest this thing really was. We found out that the Earth Summit was sponsored by corporations. It was actually, I believe, the first UN event to have taken serious sponsorship from companies. We're talking about ICI, Imperial Chemical Industries, as it was once known. We're talking about Mitsubishi, the largest forest destroyer on the planet. We're talking about ARCO. We're talking about the kind of companies you wouldn't want paying for your Congress. I wouldn't want paying for the Australian Parliament. So why the hell are they bankrolling a half of the Parliament of the planet? Because they needed to co-opt it, that's why, and because the UN was underfunded, as we know. In 1992, the concern, the palpable emotion, the fervour of Earth Day 1990, all of those kids on the street, all of us giving a damn about it, was captured and hijacked and strangled by the corporations who took over the Earth Summit. What did they do? They killed the Convention on Forests. hasn't been resurrected, and nothing's been done. If you want an update on the state of the world's rainforest, ask Randy Hayes. I can give it to you in a couple of words. Not very good. You know, it basically killed the climate convention. George Bush rocked up one day here to the New York negotiations at the PrepCom, the preparatory committee meetings, to say the U.S. way of life is not up for negotiation. And in so saying, targets, timetables, any real attempt to avert runaway greenhouse effect was destroyed. And that was because U.S. way of life wasn't not up for negotiation. U.S. corporate profits were not up for negotiation. The fact of the matter is, the gas companies, which line the pockets of the politicians, are bilking us at the gas pump. We could be driving around in far more fuel-efficient cars or alternative energy cars, any number of technological solutions to the people transit problems that is the U.S. way of life, without having to destroy the future climate of this planet. But the U.S. corporate profit-making machine was not up for negotiation for George Bush. That's where, in Rio, this whole notion of sustainable development became popularized, this answer that the Brundtland Commission had come up with to the environment and development crises of the planet. And what happened, if Gro Harlem Brundtland, the Prime Minister of Norway who headed that commission, had said, these principles of sustainable development are as powerful as liberty, equality, and fraternity were to the feudal French. So if that's right, if they were really those historic principles of change, then what happened was, we gave power to the Bourbon to storm the Bastille. We stupidly allowed the powers of the status quo to maintain the status quo and to kill the forces for change and enlightenment at that time. That's what the Earth Summit was about, and that was just the first incidents of the United Nations taking money from the corporations that rule the world. I inveigle you to get involved and help us out keeping these corporations off our back and out of the UN. Thank you.
That was Danny Kennedy, the outgoing director of Project Underground. Their website is www.moles.org. That's www.moles.org. Danny Kennedy and Richard Grossman spoke at the day-long counter-teach-in to the Millennium Meeting of the United Nations, organized by the International Forum on Globalization. This is the fourth program in an 8-part series on the complicity of the leadership of the United Nations with globalization and corporations. It was recorded in September of 2000 in New York. An audio tape that includes today's program is $12. The transcript of this full 4-hour series is $12 as well. For a credit card order, call us toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE and let us know if you want the transcript or the tape. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. Or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.